Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, and everybody, we got voice over veteran Joel Gibbs for a special chat on Francis Ford Coppola. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. Nice to be here with you and your audience.
Absolutely. Guys, this has been a big process. We've been talking to each other for at least a good 5 months now. Prepping this. Tell us a little bit about your career before we get into your relation to Coppola's filmography.
How many hours do we have for this, Cam?
It can be as long as you want. You know,
I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. I've been the voiceover business that I've been in for many decades is kind of an outreach of being a 4 or 5 year old ventriloquist many, many years ago, where I was assigning voices to all my puppets and dummies and marionettes and whatever. And I somehow was blessed with a gift to be able to do, I don't know, hundreds of celebrity voices and dialects and characters and cartoons and narrators and what have you. And that became the central part of my business over the years, writing and producing radio and TV commercials and supplying all of these voices. At the same time, I managed to absorb a wealth of information crammed in my head about the entertainment industry, movies, television, music, what have you, and became somewhat of a historian. I had for many years syndicated movie talk show that reached markets all over America. So I would talk to people about all kinds of subjects, mostly movies, but you know, the entertainment industry and in general. And yeah, I've always said that, I don't know every single thing there is to know. However, what is in the hard drive inside my skull is way, way more than what is necessary for any half-normal human being to remember.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it is hard to even describe the kind of jokes we'll make about just, you know, famous or infamous areas of film history. Some people just, it just goes over their heads because, like you say, it's not only either too much info, but it's kind of a five-part joke, if you will.
Well, over the years doing my show, it occurred to me that, you know, largely as an entertainer, which I've been all my life in various, you know, shapes and forms, that just because I knew all this information, to just spew facts, you know, endlessly would be incredibly boring. So what I had developed, at least through my radio shows and, well, conversations with others too, was to just get conversations going, fun conversations that were interactive. And if in the conversation some you know, arcane factoid was something in my brain, then I would, you know, draw that information from the well to just fuel the conversation. But just to yak on about, I know this and I know that and whatever, it can really be kind of boring. So I wasn't really into that. I like having conversations with people.
Right. There's got to be some kind of connecting link to it all, as well as just showing that, you know, why is this info pretty and fascinating? You know, you got to have a narrative to form it all. And like you say, you've been blessed to just been able to be part of just being syndicated and having these various personas, and it can still be a story even if you're doing just a skit, you know?
That's a good point. I happen to love stories and storytelling and being a storyteller myself. So I think it's just much more fun for the listener or the audience to be entertained rather than just purely educated. You know, let's just have a good time together. That was always my thing.
Right. You need just a persona to go along with it. It can't just be, and now class, you're dismissed.
Exactly. So, and you know, like I'm also, you know, been known to tell, you know, thousands of jokes too. And because of what I do, when I tell a joke, I'm always telling it in character voices and things like that. So it's like you ask me to tell a joke, you end up getting a little mini movie, you know, for better or worse.
Mini summary. Alrighty. So just connecting that to Coppola, were you already a huge fan, or you ended up working with him in his?
Well, I had known about, I started getting really intensely interested in film, essentially. I mean, I was always a movie lover my whole life, but I started really paying attention to film and film history when I was in my late teens. And I was familiar with the name Francis Ford Coppola for some movies he had made, called, like You're a Big Boy Now, and his old, like, school, you know, college type stuff, Dementia 13, and, you know, and directed Finian's Rainbow, of all things, when Hollywood thought that everybody wanted a musical. But obviously, in mid-March of 1972, here in downtown Philadelphia, where I've lived in the Philadelphia area all my life, I went to the Fox Theater because I knew this movie, The Godfather, was going to be something special. And much like the scene where Michael has just arrived in Sicily and he just gets hit by the thunderbolt, according to Fabrizio and Kahlo. When he sees Apollonia, that is what happened to me when I saw that film the first time. I got hit hard by the thunderbolt, and I was utterly consumed. Now, this is a 3-hour film, and I went to see it at like 10 a.m. in the morning, and I figured, I'm sitting here. And, you know, in those days, they didn't chase you out of the theater. You know, I sat through it a second time and didn't quite realize that I had actually sat through it 3 times. They didn't have cell phones in those days. So at this point, it's well after dinner, and I'm like 19 years old, whatever I was, and still living at home. My mother hadn't heard from me, and she put some calls out to the authorities wondering where I was. So when I say I got hit by the thunderbolt, I got hit hard.
First, you were basically taking the hit, so to speak. Then second time, you were observing. Then the third time, you were basically enjoying having looked at all the details.
And interestingly enough, the one thing I remember very clearly, you know, I was a very big Marlon Brando fan anyway. And, you know, at that time, he was considered box office poison by Hollywood. But I was so enthralled by him. But I do recall, and I don't know whether it was because of the print or the way sound was in 1972 or these giant theaters or whatever, but I was having a tough time understanding some degree of what Brando was saying as but I stuck, maybe that's why I sat through it three times to really understand it. And you know, here we are almost 50 years later, and I can't tell you, there is no way for me. It's a good thing I figured out what he was saying, because when I learned to do the voice, there is no way for me to calculate how many commercials and projects and God knows what in which I've done that voice and many of the voices from the film. So thank you, Marlon, for mumbling and forcing me to figure it out.
Yeah, a little known fact. I always forget the name of it. I thought it was Splendor in the Grass or something, but I know Coppola had done like an uncredited like rewrite on an earlier Brando picture. It was like in between like his musicals and his other Roger Corman productions. But yeah, he definitely was going to fight and get his way with everything, because as many people seem to forget, you know, filmmakers don't always have a say. There are plenty of times where they're hired guns in between the project where they have some more creative control on. And as I said, you know, Coppola did Godfather 1, so he could do a movie he actually wanted to do called The Conversation. Then he did Godfather 2, so he could then do, you know, Apocalypse Now.
Well, yeah, he always, and he still professes to this day, and, you know, I believe him, that his intent in that time, late 60s, early 70s, was to make small, you know, independent-ish type films. That was his thing. Things that were more along the line of The Conversation. And, you know, they came to him to direct this, and you know, the story goes that Paramount, you know, the movie studios have the old adage that William Goldman, the screenwriter of Butch Cassidy and Marathon Man and a lot of other, you know, wonderful things like that, that he's basically the guy that's credited with the very famous line in Hollywood, nobody knows anything. And yeah, really, the suits and the executives, they were playing, you know, in the summer of 69, when the book The Godfather came out and was the absolute summer read. I mean, every human being on a beach or by a pool was reading The Godfather in the summer of 1969. So Paramount had grabbed up the rights, that's another story, and decided, you know, typically to do something stupid, which was, let's put this together on the cheap. You know, let's hammer out this movie. We'll do it. We're not going to do a period piece. It'll be a modern thing, and we'll shoot it cheap in Kansas City or something like that. And they brought Coppola in, and Coppola was like, no, I want to do a film where, and he said, I can quote, smell the spaghetti. and you know, they fought him on everything. He still to this day, as much as this, you know, obviously launched his career and made him the famous person he was, talented as he is, to this day, he will tell you that the making of The Godfather was filled with anguish on so many levels and in so many directions, you know, the casting, the budget, the locations, just everything about it, what was an impossible situation.
All right, hold up for a minute. Okay. Construction set. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. He pretty much ended up just kind of knocking some sense into some of the executives, even going so far as to even note that, you know, if you want this, you got to spend this amount of money on that. And it is kind of wild how it didn't receive even the best acclaim that we know it for now. Back then, it had some overall good reviews, but it did have some pretty mediocre and lukewarm reviews that kind of don't get talked about as much. And I think it was just the fact that he merged two, you know, both movies together, you know, for, it was either CBS or NBC. I think that made a bigger impression on it, just showing how he really was a pretty calculated storyteller.
Well, actually, what happened by the time NBC took 1 and 2 in around 76-ish or so, And they re-edited the whole thing in kind of a chronological order, inserted some deleted scenes. By then, it was a gigantic phenomenon, and he was just the star of the universe. So the NBC showing of that version, which these days I think they're calling it the saga. There's so many versions of the re-edited, you know, types of things that they've done over the years. That didn't add anything more to his credibility. Quite frankly, the executives were, their jaws dropped when they saw on the very first day, the intent to see this movie was so overwhelming that the lines were going all around the block and people had to wait 3-4 hours, you know, for the next showing. It wasn't like an hour, 40-minute movie. And this is in March. This is in March in places, you know, in the Northeast Corridor, in New York, Philadelphia, Boston, cities like that. People were waiting in the snow for hours. It was quite a phenomenon. And but they fought him on the cast, and they fought him on Brando and Pacino. They fought him about the budget, on locations, the things that the chairman of Paramount, or actually Gulf and Western, that owned Paramount at the time, was an insane guy named Charlie Bluedorn, and he just was an arbitrary pain in the ass on everything, and Coppola endlessly proved him wrong. But Coppola figured out early on how to beat the system. For instance, Charlie Bluedorn, the chairman, absolutely said, there is no way whatsoever that Marlon Brando is going to be in this film. He is box office poison. It's impossible to deal with. So whatever you're doing, whatever you're thinking, he will not be in this film. So Coppola, along with Mario Puzo, had written the script with Brando in mind. And when you think about some of the people that not only the studio was considering to play Vito, Don Vito Corleone, and the actors and people that were begging to play the part, it's mind-boggling to think that anybody other than Brando could have done this. So after the chairman had put his foot down and said, you will not get this concession whatsoever, Coppola took a sort of a primitive reel-to-reel video recorder to Marlon Brando's house up on Mulholland Drive. And with him, he brought Italian salami and cheeses and anchovies and Italian cigars and crackers, and put out a plate and whatever. And Brando comes out after about an hour and a half from his bedroom in a bathrobe, and his hair, which was very long, tied in a ponytail behind his head. And Coppola had set up the camera. He was ready for him. And Brando sat down and immediately stuffed some cotton and tissues into his cheeks, because in his mind, he thought Don Corleone should kind of look a bit like a bulldog.
I do recall the cotton, but yeah, I did forget about the bulldog.
And they shot this audition, or whatever you want to call it. They shot this footage, and Coppola brought it back to the chairman of Paramount to say, I want you to look at this guy. We auditioned this guy. And they had no idea who it was they were looking at, but the executive said, we don't know who this is, but this is Don Corleone. And it was like, ha ha.
Right. It was like, told you so. Got a proof of concept.
Exactly. And the other fight during production, once the shoot had started, the other fight was about Pacino, whom Charlie Bluedorn, the chairman, kept referring to as the midget. Pacino was bound to lose his job until that magic moment when the executives watched the dailies, the rushes of the scenes that were shot in Louis's restaurant, where He takes care of Saluzzo. And when they saw that, it was like, okay, we'll let the midget keep his job.
Right. You had to really just show them visual proof that they were way off. Well, and it got even more taxing because, you know, they had already had the problem at first, according to a few film history books I remember reading, where it's just like, you got to adapt this, again, bestseller. It's still the routine now, but, you know, boy, was it even more so back in the day. Got to adapt the first, you know, great book that you see.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we want to make this. And at the same time, it glamorizes the mafia. And at the same time, not every studio wants to touch it, but they really all secretly want to touch it. Yeah.
Well, you know, they weren't worried so much about glamorizing the mafia and that sort of thing. I mean, because first of all, it had been a long, long time since a movie about whether it be the mafia or gangsters or whatever you want to call them, had been either made or had been a success. Prior to Godfather, Paramount had invested in a movie called The Brotherhood, which starred Kirk Douglas and a little-known actor named Alex McCord, who didn't go on to an illustrious career. And the movie tanked beyond tanking. So they were very, very reluctant. They knew they had a great bestseller in a book on their hands, but they were very reluctant to cooperate in any way, to spend any money and do anything, because they didn't take the movie seriously. But fortunately for all of us, Coppola really understood this tremendously. And that is not to take anything away from Mario Puzo. A very rare, very, very rare situation where a director and a writer collaborated so well and so thoroughly and so willingly. You know, most times it's like, write the screenplay, put the script to my desk and go on vacation and see you later. That was not the case with these films.
Yeah, he gave him his blessing. He's like, okay, you can rework this scene. You know, it works as a movie. They both understood it enough. He had had enough, you know, offers, and he was tired of seeing other people, you know, do mockeries or knockoffs of his work without his blessing. So, yeah, he's like, all right, this is it. Want to do an official, you know, adaptation of the book. This guy gets it.
For me, the best analogy is that, you know, I am the self-proclaimed most passionate Beatlemaniac that ever walked the face of the earth. I know there are a few people that would disagree with me, but for me, The Godfather is very much like the Beatles. It is this once-in-a-lifetime alignment of the stars where everything just went perfectly, and you can't imagine... You can't imagine The Godfather or the entire cast, anybody playing John, Paul, George, and Ringo the way these guys did in The Godfather. So that's the way I feel about it.
It really is. I mean, because you do have just some serious rock stars who were just waiting to get the next, you know, level of their careers, and this helped them. But, I mean, can you even see Martin Sheen, who was the original choice as playing Michael Corleone, and...
Well, actually, the very, very original choices for that Hollywood, that the studio and Hollywood were looking at for Michael, the two biggest people that they wanted were Robert Redford and Ryan O'Neal.
The pretty boys. There you go. Yeah.
Well, right. The pretty boy. We'll just cast them because they're popular. Redford, you know, just is coming off Butch Cassidy and a couple things. And it's like, wait a minute. We're doing a thing about the mob, about Italian Americans. And the argument was, well, you know, if you really want to get technical, hundreds and hundreds of years ago, the Italians really were a bit more blonde and Aryan. And it's like, well, this isn't, we're not doing this film in ancient times. This is, you know, the 1940s and 50s. So we need authenticity here. And, you know, either through sticking to his guns, which Coppola didn't really have the power to do, but being crafty about it, we got the Beatles of movies. What can I say?
Essentially it. I mean, it also helped that Martin Sheen did put in a word for Pacino. He's like, hey, I know you guys want me. One of you guys wants me in the movie, but I know this guy who I'm going to the actor studio with. He's a cool guy.
Right. And I don't know if you're, whether your audience will recognize a few of these other names, but that we were just a moment ago talking about the people that either studio wanted or specific actors who wanted to play Don Corleone. And between in that list included people like Danny Thomas, who was a big star, a stand-up comedian and star of 50s TV shows, Ernest Borgnine.
Oh, wow.
McHale's Navy and movies and Marty and, things like that. There's even a crooner from vaudeville, the 1920s, 30s, named Rudy Valli, who probably no one listening to this conversation would even know at all. The closest they got to someone that maybe might have been able to pull it off was Laurence Olivier. At least he was considered one of the greatest actors of all time at that time. And he might have pulled it off. But again, there's not one human being in the cast of those movies that you can see somebody else playing the part. It's absolute perfection.
Definitely not anywhere near as good or as well cast or, like you say, like ethnicity appropriate. And, and like you say, I mean, it wasn't that people do act like the cast was ready to go. It's like, no, it wasn't.
Not at all. You can go on YouTube and see Robert De Niro's audition to be Sonny. You can see James Caan's audition to be Michael, sitting in military type of, uniform they could grab from central casting, sitting next to Diane Keaton and improvising. And you have De Niro trying to be Sonny in a kind of a pork pie hat. He's almost like Popeye Doyle in The French Connection. What was meant to be was meant to be. It happened. Aren't we happy?
Absolutely. I mean, and I can't even tell you how many times they've re-edited the whole trilogy together. I know there was like a version of the saga that actually in recent years, as far back as like even 2016, started airing on some of the movie channels.
Yes.
And it was weird because it's like they edited all the R-rated content back in. And yeah, they just added the scenes of.
Well, I will tell you that the only chronological editing of part one and part two that I've ever seen that I really thought was very well done was the one that debuted on, and I think it's the one you're referring to, debuted on Cinemax again, yes, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, something like that. And that was really well done. They inserted some deleted scenes that never made it to the original movies. But Coppola has, and I agree with him, he has gone on the record as saying that if you like the way that was put together, that's all well and good, but it wasn't meant to be like that, especially when you consider part two, because the whole point of that movie was the juxtaposition of the old scenes and the new scenes and watching the rise to power of the young Vito Corleone as evidenced against the rise of Michael Corleone once he was in power, and the very basic differences where the son is definitely not the father. And that was the whole point of doing the second film the way they did. So Coppola is really not a fan of the chronological, like, 7-hour version.
He's kind of like James Cameron was with Terminator 2 and The Abyss, where he's like, there are no director's cuts in my mind. These special editions are just, an enhancement, so to speak, for the, crowd that loves the movie and wants a little more,
and a little bit more money, for the studio. I mean, how many versions of Blade Runner Final Cut are we going to get? Give me a break.
I can't blame him though for like deciding to start doing director's cuts, especially for part three of Godfather and the final cut of Apocalypse Now, where he took out some of the scenes from the last redux that were overpaid.
And yet both of them, for me, were complete failures. You know, you can go on for a long time discussing the very obvious problems with Godfather 3. And don't get me wrong, I happen to like the film a lot. It is not on the level of 1 and 2.
No.
There are two very obvious basic problems with 3. However, recent months, when they came out with, when Coppola came out with this re-edited The Godfather Part 3, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone, I was like, well, what's he doing that's going to be different with this? And it turned out that he just took out some scenes and just shifted a couple things and actually omitted one, like, final type of scene that sort of goes along with the new title of this re-edited version of the movie. It didn't make sense to me at all. It was like, okay, I'll probably never watch this again because there's no point. If I'm going to watch 3, I'll just watch 3. End of story.
Yeah, I've only seen like a comparison on like Movie Censorship, which often shows, you know, different cuts of different movies. And yeah, it looked like it was very minor to where I was like, yeah, I'm not going to invest any time in that.
Well, I kind of had to, being the Godfather freak that I am. It was like, well, I have to watch this. And it just, you know, just left me a little confused and a little cold.
Well, and I don't know. Some of these films kind of do better when you got a bunch of film, you know, fans together in one room. And like you say, then at the same time, you know, if you want to see it, then you can't wait in line for other people to join you. You got to just go out and see it. But yeah, I mean, I think even the Wicca for Godfather has often been one of my favorite Wiccas to read, because there's some very interesting themes and backstory information on how certain characters got conceived and how they vary in the book versus the movie portrayal.
Right.
I find it so funny that the one bodyguard of the Corleones that goes, you know, to send a message and gets, you know, brutally, you know, knifed to death, let alone on his hand. And
yeah,
I loved how Coppola noticed his acting ability was limited, but he was already cast. And the guy, I forget his name, but in real life, he was an actual bouncer. And he had, of course, at one point or another, helped out some shady nightclub or mob.
Yeah, he was connected to the mob to a minor degree. And also his real name was Lenny Montana. And he playing Luca Brasi. And he didn't have any acting experience. He actually showed up as sort of a Teamster driver on the set. And they went, this guy's very interesting. He was a wrestler.
I do recall that part, yeah.
Yeah, in the 50s. And when you see that scene at the wedding in the first film, where Michael and Kay have finally arrived and they're sitting at the table, and in the background you see Luca Brasi sort of talking to himself, and you know, Kay says, who's that scary looking guy, and you see him, you know, mumbling. That is actually while Coppola is shooting the scene of Michael and Kay, in the background that is Lenny Montana as Luca practicing
his
lines.
Yeah.
And Coppola noticed it, and he said, just let's keep rolling, and then we'll find a way to use that. And they did in the Godfather study, where Luca was, you know, obviously very nervous about addressing the Godfather in this manner on the day of his daughter's wedding. So, again, just great, great patience, great filmmaking, great thought. It another example of the stars being in alignment. There's so many examples.
Oh, absolutely. And that B-roll was just so needed, because you need that character's momentum before his inevitable death scene, you know?
Yes. So
better scene, if you got really nothing to connect the rest of the dots. And it, like you say, instead of just trying to teach a non-actor to not act, it's like, let's just focus on some other stuff and just make it work. And like you say, I mean, it was, he just was really good at just saying, okay, you know, we can add in a few scenes that really will actually help the movie versus let's ad lib and see, you know, what does or doesn't work. And it's like, no, he was very calculating. And
yeah,
like I say, that's just a great scene in general, because you're just like, oh, what's he nervous about? I thought he's a tough looking, you know, henchman.
There was, you know, there was a lot of pranks and a lot of fun. The cast adored each other to a person. And one of the pranks that happened is when Lenny Montana, as Luca Brasi, was inside the study and wanted to express his gratitude, you know, for being invited and give the Godfather a gift, you know, for Connie. That when the camera was over Lenny Montana's shoulder looking at Brando, what you didn't see was when they started, Lenny Montana had wrapped his tongue in duct tape, and somebody with like a magic marker on the duct tape had written F-U. And that just destroyed Brando. So, you know, it's and it's amazing when you think of the kind of pranks and the repartee that went on, that it that Coppola was still able to hold it together. And it's like, okay, now let's shoot the scene. Let's do this for real. Laughter is over. Another Lenny Montana, Luca Brasi story.
Absolutely. And Coppola, you know, he's from the same circle. We've already covered De Palma on here. We're going to cover Lucas and Spielberg eventually, but it's definitely Scorsese. But yeah, being from that same, you know, interior of Five Pals, you know, they both all were just very good at being patient and getting control of their studio crew. And, you know, much like Spielberg on Jaws, you know, Coppola just knew that, you know, you can't lose control of your crew. You got to have your confidence, because the crew gets that aura. They get that scent of, you know, trust versus distrust.
And well, it's being, you know, as a director myself, I can tell you, you not only have to have the confidence of your crew, but in my humble opinion, you have to treat your crew really well, because then the crew will give you back 110%. It's really, it's crucial on a set, you know, at least on the sets that I've run, that you have a sense of camaraderie, that, okay, I'm the director. Ultimately, I'm going to make the final decision. Somebody has to, but beyond that, the idea of being open to input from everybody is a marvelous thing in filmmaking and television directing and whatever, because you just never know where the great idea is going to come from. I mean, put a lot of little good ideas on the table, and from that, you will get a great idea.
Absolutely. And if you want to share any more stories of your film set experiences, please, if you want to, that's fine. But yeah, I mean, it goes a long way. People aren't going to injure their name or legacy, and at the same time, they're definitely going to avoid certain filmmakers or names if they just find that they, you know, fail to take any feedback or input that they're giving or noting. And if the film just seems like it's just going to come off as just very unprofessionally run.
Right. And
nowadays, we really don't hear too much about that. We'll hear about just rare occasions, like maybe overseas, like how De Palma's last film, Domino, went, where it was just
not too well.
And we've heard about other ones, like the Lord brothers, who had worked on just goofy films, getting fired from a Star Wars film because that's exactly what they were doing. They were goofing around, not following the script, and way over time and budget.
and sometimes, you know, based on your own persona or just your thoughts and emotions, you know, Hollywood, the suits, the executives, unless you are at the top of the food chain and you can say, stay the hell off my set, you're not even permitted to come into the soundstage, which is not the case for many directors, you know, the Spielberg, Scorsese's, you know, all those guys,
yeah,
you know, have that power. But other than that, the pressure of being constantly second guessed and being given notes and the notes being so absolutely insane, you know, that we, you know, can we have a happy ending? You know, let's do a film where the key scene is the person, you know, dies at the end. That's what the story is all about. And then you get a note that says, does he really have to die? I mean, that's maddening.
Really is maddening. And in some ways it's even trivial, and it's just very face-palming, because it's like, okay, I guess I better say yes. And then I won't include that, and everyone's happy. Or I got to just go along with it and be unhappy and disown the film, you know, 5 years later, you know.
or you do the crafty thing, you know, people, all the major directors at one time or another, Kubrick, Scorsese, Spielberg, you know, just Hitchcock, everybody, they've all, when they've had pressure from the suits, or if the suits were there, they would plan purposely to shoot something that was completely, allegedly their idea to make the suits happy, and include something, like a trade-off. I'll give you this if you give me this. And it's a never-ending battle, unless you're, you know, in that top 10 food chain, or at any time in your career, you know, you are the number one, you know. That's what it's, right. That's ultimately what it's all about. It's, you know, they're all essentially artists. So what are you going to do? You're going to tell Van Gogh, you know what, why are you doing that blue? Okay, why don't you make that red? Well, it's like, I'm the artist. It's coming from my sensibility, from my persona. So could you just leave me alone? Well, I think it should be orange, quite frankly.
I think your ear should be reattached.
Right. Exactly. You know, Kirk Douglas making Lust for Life. And it's like, do we have to cut off his ear? Can it be like the tip of his finger? No, because that's not what happened. It's hey, Hollywood, da 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 da.
Probably any business anywhere, where it's just like, George Lucas said it famously, where it's like, you know, money, you know.
I had
are not filmmakers.
I had some wonderful conversations years ago with Norman Jewison, the director of In the Heat of the Night and Moonstruck. Lovely. And, you know, The Cincinnati Kid, and, you know, some of the greatest films ever made. And he had decided, and it happened, to call his autobiography, This Terrible Business Has Been Very Good to Me.
It's a great book. Yeah.
Great book. Great guy, too. Very talented. And,
oh, yeah.
And he told every if you read any director's autobiography, there are always stories about, you know, get a load of this fight that I had with so-and-so about such and such. It's, you know, and by the time, but of course, you know, when Godfather broke every box office record imaginable at the time, it really was the first true gigantic blockbuster. Not that other movies hadn't made a lot of money, because you adjust them for inflation, and, you know, there's lots of other blockbusters, but The Godfather was the first in line to set the tone, then Jaws, then Star Wars, and now here we are. And, you know, the business has changed, but once The Godfather had blown everybody's mind, that was when it was like, oh, you want a second one? Well, here's a piece of paper. Here's my terms. You know, Al Pacino, you pay me $35,000 for the first one. I'll take $500,000 for the second one, and so forth. The only, you know, we were talking about three a little bit, you know, about the two things that stick out. And aside from obviously Sofia Coppola and the issues there, what to me killed the potential of Godfather 3 is because the studio would not pay Robert Duvall what he should have gotten. You know, you want to pay Pacino $5 million? Well, I've already won an Oscar as best actor. Pacino hasn't. Give me 3 or 4. No, we won't pay you. Then goodbye. And it suffered for it.
It really was ridiculous, because Duvall was easily better known, and yet for whatever reason, like, they just were betting money on guys who were often the lead, like Pacino. And it's like, man, okay.
Well, again, it was short-sightedness. It was how can you not understand that this story, the Tom Hagen character, is an absolutely essential part of the story. The man playing him has already won an Oscar 7 years earlier for Best Actor. He's one of the greatest actors we've ever known. How do you not pay him? It's been 16 years. You think there's not a wannabe factor for a Godfather 3? And to have Duvall and the whole cast in it, you know.
We got to kill him off screen.
Yeah, we're just going to kill him off screen and put George Hamilton in as his ostensible replacement. Give me a break. Stop. So.
Right. And instead of calculated, you know, stealthy mob attacks, we're going to have a helicopter ambush. Where the hell did
that exactly. And, you know, and then Coppola just... I wouldn't say he made the big mistake, but, you know, after the success of One and Two and The Conversation, he jumps into the Philippines and everything that could possibly go wrong over like a 3-4 year period goes wrong. Everything. So,
yeah, years before Heaven's Gate and other, even Street Fighter the movie, you had Apocalypse Now where... And, you know, I mean, we got to say, it's just very intriguing. I've interviewed Joe Estevez, who was, you know, Martin Sheen's younger brother and voice fill-in a few different times. And he noted in a book interview years ago that he thought the, you know, documentary on it was bullshit. I think some of it is valid, but some of it is kind of also kind of downplayed, and it's like, yeah, it was a chaotic experience.
But you know, at the heart of it all, you're shooting in a foreign country. The government is not being particularly agreeable. You cast Harvey Keitel in the lead role, and then he doesn't work out. So then you cast Martin Sheen, who has a heart attack on set. Then the monsoons come and wipe out the sets, completely destroy everything that you've built. But in the end, it was a whole hell of a lot better film than Heaven's Gate, that's for sure.
Just an excellent cast. Lawrence Fishburne lied about his age to get on the set of the movie.
Yeah, he was like 14 years old or something like that. Yeah.
Absolutely. The boat captain, Albert Hall, and Frederick Forrest is the right hand. Just were just wonderful additions. Adding Dennis Hopper and Marlon Brando was chaotic, but is also just a very big highlight. And it's just interesting just seeing, you know, how... Colonel Kurtz is just one of the best villains of all time because, again, you just got whatever good villain you have in every kind of movie where, whether it is Olivier in Marathon Man or even, you know, Darth Vader, for lack of a better comparison, is like you just got to have a suspenseful villain and then reveal him in the last 20 minutes, you know?
and you know, Brando, you know, that line, the horror, he was a horror to work with. He told Coppola that, you know, I had a heart-to-heart talk with him, and I'd like to play Colonel Kurtz as a bagel. How do you respond to that? Like,
right.
You know, Marlon, give me a break, really. Help me out here, man. You know.
Great in it, but I can tell you, I would have slipped my wrist making it. I would have been like, all right, fuck you.
You know, it was, you look at that documentary, Hearts of Darkness, and, you know, I wasn't there, you weren't there, but I think it presents a pretty true picture of the madness, not only the madness of the plot, which is at the heart of the plot, but the madness of making that movie. And, you know.
Why is for his wife to be filming it, because she got to launch her, you know, film career. Apparently Charlie Sheen and Ramon Estevez have a few bit parts, but they're very hard to make out, I think. And It's an overall just very just well done epic. It's unlike any other kind of spectacle. I mean, I tie it up there with The Lawrence of Arabia, definitely, in terms of just a movie that, much like even your take on the first Godfather, is just you really cannot take your eyes off it. It doesn't matter if there's a battle going on or if there's, again, one of the many iconic speeches, like, I love the smell of napalm and all that. And you really do feel like you are in this,
you're immersed in it. You're on that boat. You're on that trip. But again, a great filmmaker will immerse you in the narrative, and you feel like you're there. I don't know about you. I mean, I've spent most of my life watching movies at the movies, and you know, now we have TV and streaming and this and that and whatever. And every once in a while, I become conscious of the fact that I've forgotten peripherally that there is like a rectangle in front of me. You feel like you are in the movie. And, you know, that's
the honor of reevaluating the movie in a college film study class. And yeah, the Redux of Apocalypse was one of them. And it definitely made me reevaluate the movie all these years. And it was, again, it was definitely the way to see it. And sometimes that's just how you have to see it, I think. But like we've said before, you know, with certain movies, you know, I don't have a problem with my, you know, high HD, you know, home theater system. But at the same time, there are certain ones where it's like, yeah, this merits a matinee.
Well, you know, with the pandemic, it's hard to really know whether, you know, the movie theater going, you know, the experience is going to come back. I would like to see that. You know, there's a story. I feel that movie watching ideally is better as a communal experience. I always, you know, you sit in a theater, the lights go down, you can smell the popcorn, there's a few hundred people surrounding you, everybody's laughing at the same time, screaming and jumping and crying at the same time. I think that's the way it was for decades, and I think it's the way it's the most ideal thing. Steven Spielberg tells a story about, you know, it was a long time between the time that Close Encounters was in theaters until it premiered on home video in the 80s. And he remembers, you know, carrying these exceptionally heavy film cans, you know, 4, 5, 6 reels, and it felt like substance to him. And now here it was all reduced to this little plastic waiver with a little clear window in the middle of, you know, a VHS tape. And he said, it's just not the same. It's not the same. And he's right. He's absolutely right. I feel he's right.
Well, and very much so, because I mean, for years, you know, you would have alternate cuts to movies. You would also have just very reduced, compressed sound and other stuff that was not how it was originally meant to be seen. And nowadays, I think the internet really has ruined a lot of movies for us. There's a lot of basis and merit in it, but there have been plenty of other ones where it's like we see snobs today who will, again, make fun of the fact that they see, you know, stuff that they're not supposed to see. And it's like, well, you've only seen movies on Blu-ray, so yeah, you're going to see, if you've seen it multiple times, you're going to see stuff you never saw before because you've just paid too much detailed attention to it. But don't, you know, knock a movie.
Well, you know, to be clear, and I prefer the communal experience, but, you know, and again, especially because of the pandemic and everybody getting really super used to sitting on their couch and pausing it and watching it. You know, maybe you have a, you know, a theater sound system and what have you, and you're watching a 60 inch screen. There's nothing wrong with that at all. That's nice and convenient, and because the public, though a communal experience in a theater, I think is much preferred. The public has gone completely nutsoid. So you have teenagers with lasers and people who bring their babies, you know,
theaters. What was a turnoff? I went to some of the worst theaters of all time. And it's like, and to make it worse, you'd have just the most overdone blockbusters that were very lazy, terrible effects and everything. Yeah. And so, yeah, if it's a movie that's a spectacle and I actually really love the premise and everything and the talent involved, then I will definitely see it in the theater. And then there's other ones where it's like, okay, I'm going to watch this at 3 a.m. on HBO and just go to sleep because it's...
I thoroughly agree with you. I had gotten to the point over recent years where, you know, I'm very lucky in that, you know, I'm a member of the Critics' Choice Association, so I have a lot of perks. I get to go to theaters for free, and they send me the Academy screeners and the DVDs all year long, and, you know, links and that. So I have a lot of very cool, creature comforts that I can take advantage of. But. You know, if a Star Wars or James Bond film or something really special comes into a theater, it's like, you know what? I want to go to the movies to see this. I want to sit in the theater.
James Bond especially, and how they've handled this recent movie has just been atrocious. It's just like, no, you got to push it back. You can't just try and wait for the COVID numbers to go down or sell it to Amazon. It's just bad business.
Well, listen, you know, I'm absolutely sure, I'd bet the house on it, that the producers of the new James Bond film are not worried at all. And now, I mean, that film was supposed to hit theaters well over a year ago.
It cost a lot of money. And they,
you know, we all know what happened, but the want-to-see factor for that, especially since it is supposed to be, you know, the last Daniel Craig, Bond film and whatever. A James Bond film is sort of like audience proof. There's a gigantic audience and intent to see for something like that. So, you know, believe me, every day they're looking at the numbers, they're looking at the CDC, they're looking at what's happening in theaters, and supposedly, as I understand it, sometime maybe by October-ish, give or take, they're planning again to release that into theaters. but you see, what the pandemic did, and I actually think it's a good thing, and this should have been done 20 years ago. They didn't have streaming then, but still, the idea of, okay, you know, people, couples, young couples, the cost of going out to a theater, you know, if you got $15-$20 a ticket, the babysitter, the burger that you're going to eat, the gas, the parking, the, you know, whatever the case may be, it's, you know, it's $100 night when just to see a movie, and you might end up not particularly liking the movie. So, and the studios are saying, yeah, but we want that fat, you know, ticket price. We want the, you know, that person to walk through the turnstile. But the idea of releasing something in theaters and on demand, you know, on the same day or virtually at the same time, maybe a week, 10 days later, worse comes to worse, that time has come. And the pandemic, it wasn't just streaming, but the pandemic has forced the hand, and that's why it's all going to change. And because people are now very used to sitting on their ass very comfortably with their home theater and big screen and watching what they want.
Yeah, they definitely embraced it around like 08 to 2011, but it was just very subtle. It was like, okay, if you got a cable package, you can order it now for $4, but it was a limited, you know, festival type release movie. Now, like you say, now it's bigger movies, and it's like, okay, you can, as we've seen earlier, you can rent it for $20 on Amazon or through a Universal or Paramount Disney streaming site.
Well, $20 is less than $100, right? Mm-hmm. And you're at home, and if you need
expenses,
right, need to take a bathroom break or catch a phone call or whatever, they have called the pause, right? So What do you complain? You know, I'm paying $5 a month for Amazon or for Netflix or whatever, and they want to charge me $12.99 for this new movie. What are you complaining about?
Mm-hmm. You know, I've enjoyed watching a lot of these HBO Max releases. It's like, I would have seen that eventually, but I was glad I got to see it now. You know, high definition sound.
Well, they can't, you know, the movie studios can't, they can't take the, they can't take the movie theaters completely out of the picture just yet, but it's coming. It's on its way. I mean, I hope there are always movie theaters, but these 24 plexes and all this stuff, that's going to go. That is absolutely going to go. No question.
Yeah.
No one's going to pay 15, 18, 20 bucks a ticket and all the other stuff to see, you know, the newest, you know, Pauly Shore comedy or whatever.
There's definitely a lot of oversaturation and, like you say, just outrageous prices that eventually are going to put a toll on everyone. I think it's also just kind of to the point where everyone's just kind of too busy wanting to catch up on older movies, let alone older TV shows. And so I'd rather watch that than the newest shit fest starring an actor who I used to like or something like that.
Yeah. And quite frankly, although, you know, the output of movies has been compromised for obvious reasons, no one can argue with that. The excellence, the true excellence of content on the streaming services is just enough for 20 lifetimes. I don't know how I'm ever going to get through everything that not only I want to watch, but that I've identified as being pretty damn good. It's a lot of content, and that content is competing with the official theatrical quote unquote films too. So,
yeah. Old cult drive-in movies without going to an actual drive-in, you can, there's plenty of platforms for that. You want to see, like you say, retro shows, there's a lot of free apps like Pluto and Comet TV that do that.
I got suckered into downloading the Tubi app I just wanted to check it out, and I looked at it and I went, oh, you know, there's a lot of pretty good selection of some classic stuff. And the other day it was Clint Eastwood's 91st birthday, and it was like, all right, let me watch Dirty Harry for the 5,000th time. Because I'm going to fall asleep anyway. It's like 11 o'clock and I'll just put it on. It doesn't matter. I could do karaoke to this film. So I put it on, and after about 15, 20 minutes, there was like six commercials. And now the film was completely intact. It wasn't edited or this or that or whatever, but it was like, what? Okay, right. It's a free service, but nothing's free. There is no free ride. One way or another, you pay for it.
Yeah. Essentially, Tubi's good, though. I think what they figured out is just, you know, they didn't fall to Hulu's problem for years ago before they revamped it to where you could do an ad-free service for like free extra bucks.
Right.
Where they, you know, instead of just playing the same ads or having glitches on when the ad plays, they would often just have little small warnings, and they would always keep, they're good at merging in three different ads under a minute, and it's like, that's wonderful. Don't do, you know, 3 minutes and I gotta see the same damn thing.
Yeah, well, that was not my experience with Dirty Harry. It was like, this was like, I know what you're thinking, will it be six commercials or only five?
I guess it also depends on the length. So
I suppose.
But they are good at having, all the uncut, violent, sexual content in a movie. Yeah, Prime has on occasion had to shorten certain movies and everything. I'm like, damn it, no.
Well, I'm very, very spoiled on, my, as I said, a lot of levels. And I will not watch a movie with commercials. I know it's going to be edited anyways. That's another reason not to do it. But it's like, will not do it. Not even The Godfather. If The Godfather is on,
it's gonna last 6 hours. That's not cool. It's on
the Paramount Channel or do whatever it is. It's like, no, I'm not gonna watch it. I'm tempted. I'm thinking about it, but no, I haven't
seen any ads on Paramount yet. But I'm sure something will change along the way, and everyone's gonna cry, oh bullshit. You know, that's not cool.
Everything changes, man, and everything evolves. That's just the way it is, you know.
So, well, let's reeling it back slightly to Coppola. How do you feel like he evolved over the years? A lot of people like to just say he went downhill by this movie or that movie. I think he always was pretty good at staying relevant in some fashion, but, and then
I think his skills have always been there. So as a director, I don't think he's ever lost it. I think it was really a question of the choice of material more than anything else. He's made a lot of really wonderful films. His blessing and curse in life is that everything he has ever done, will ever do, is all judged against The Godfather. So there it is. He knows that
too. That too.
But outside of The Godfather, there are definitely good things to say about Tucker and about Dracula and, The Conversation, of course, Apocalypse Now. But then he's made things like Jack. Which was like, it's not you so much, Francis, but I just don't understand. But, he's also gone through his life where he's made some goofy business decisions where he needed a paycheck. He did a John Grisham movie and it wasn't a bad movie. It was just like,
I like The Rainmaker, but yeah, it's not for everyone. It's definitely not an uplifting movie or captivating like The Conversation. That's for sure.
It's okay. It's a courtroom movie. To me, I call that a popcorn movie, something that is just entertaining enough, a decent enough story. I kind of like the actors, the play. Like, I didn't walk away and go say that sucked. Like, okay, I watched it. And if I never see it again for the rest of my life, I'll be just fine. I'll be okay. So I think it was, really more so a choice of material that just, it didn't seem to fit his talents.
I think he's thankful that no one's ever described him as just, terrible to work with and everything. He's had a good work ethic and, like you say, a good creative business and filmmaking decisions. He pretty much just always put it on the same platter. It's like, okay, money and yes, I can do the material justice. And I will like making this movie for X amount of time. Right. I'll sell my soul while also just giving it my all. He's a trooper. And like you say, I mean, he's very much about just kind of just really just taking a big step back and looking at the bigger picture, so to speak. And looking at his latest stuff, for the longest time, I had a few college buddies who were really obsessed with the movie Youth Without Youth. I didn't watch it for the longest time because it got hammered by critics.
Yeah.
I enjoy it as a standalone fantasy film, but I'm okay with people just saying, yeah, no, that was one of Coppola's lowest points. But having prepared for this episode, I went and saw the movie Tetro.
Yeah.
And that was another one, which was just mixed. Some people thought it was a return. Mm-hmm. I got to say, you definitely got closer to seeing the earlier Coppola look and feel.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt like he miscast it. Just Vincent Gallo is just not that great an actor.
I agree with you on that. Yeah. Now, not even so much right now, but even largely over the past 15, 20 years, different people come up and take your place. Right now, here in 2021, the only two directors who I can think of who have extremely active and largely still very successful careers are Spielberg and Scorsese. They've been around for the better part of 50 years. Everybody's had their clunkers, but I would say that both those guys, their batting average is pretty high, pretty damn high. Higher than Coppola's. I have great respect for Clint Eastwood, quite frankly. He's had his share of head scratchers, but overall, it took a while for either people or critics or the film community or whatever you want to call it to realize that Eastwood is a pretty damn good director. Pretty damn good. Everybody has hits and misses. Nobody bats 1,000. But there are a few guys over the, you know, you look at the career of, you know, Scorsese and Spielberg and Eastwood and Hitchcock and, you know, a few other people who largely have been batting, you know, let's call it 750. If you bat 750 in baseball, you know, they'll name stadiums after you, you know.
Yeah. Everyone's going to have a home run and everyone's going to have a few total miss. Just not even, right. Didn't make it to the first stop.
Yeah.
And like you say, I mean, I definitely can't think of anyone, any film buff that doesn't have a Scorsese or Spielberg or Clint movie in their collection at some point. And I think you could definitely say the same thing about Coppola at some point. Dennis Menave and Taylor Sheridan have often really blown me away because they definitely kind of have an old school approach that they're making right. In today's digital world.
Right. But when you say Coppola, you automatically then follow that with the word Godfather, and many people forget about so much else. They really do.
They really do. That they don't even, they might make it to Apocalypse or Conversation, but there's plenty of those who won't even make it to even Dementia 13 or...
Right. I really thought years ago that Peter Bogdanovich was going to have a long career. He for, you know, for a 4 or 5 year period, he was knocking out some great stuff, and it was very mixed genre stuff, you know, wasn't the same type of film over and over. And then his mistake was falling in love with one of his stars and making some really crappy films, and then he was done. He was finished. Over.
You know? I think he definitely got a big head, and that's why you see him often more just playing an actor. I've heard he's been a little arrogant to work with, so that
yeah.
play into yeah. a bit. Which yeah. is a shame, because hearing him talk about film is just so fascinating. I think it didn't help that, you know, as great as The Last Picture Show is, he was also coming out of, again, the 60s and 70s era.
Right.
He just had too much competition against him as well, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, kind of the same similar sort of thing happened virtually at the same time to William Friedkin, too. You know, it's like,
exactly.
Wow, what a talent. I mean, French Connection, Exorcist, Sorcerer, and then finished. Just, you know, not being paid attention to anymore. And that's got to be rough. You know, you do Last Picture Show and then you do What's Up, Doc. And you know, could two films be any more different than Last Picture Show and What's Up, Doc? And in their own way, they're both absolutely, you know, just flawless films. So it's like, ooh, we got a talent here. And now you're going to make At Long Last Love? What do you think? So they, you know, listen, people are just, you know, we're all just human beings. And, you know, there are human beings that are a little bit more self-indulgent than each other. Also, it's a business of us fans, you know, constantly telling you, you're wonderful, you're great, you're the best, you're the finest, you're the greatest, you're wonderful, we love you. And people, you hear that enough, people buy into it, and it clouds your judgment.
It really does. If you're being told that 24/7, that's not any more helpful. It's very, like you say, distracting. In a way, it's kind of works the same way that we see today's propaganda work, where it's like, okay, now, you know,
It's the person you are. I mean, how is it? You know, I mean, like I said, everybody's made clunkers, but Clint Eastwood turned like 91 yesterday, and he's got a new movie coming out. I mean, you know, and people adore him on his sets, and he's efficient. He's like two takes. Let's move on to the next scene, the next setup. It's the person you are. Ultimately, not just your artistry. And if you are lucky enough to be a great artist and you happen to be a fairly decent human being, you got a shot and you also have to have you know, a pretty good eye for material. So and so that's a rare combination. And when you see that happen, then you have long enduring careers.
Yeah, I think some of the doors are opening up where people are down to see people try a different formula each time. And like you say, there's others who it's like they just can't help it. You know, they're kind of whatever you were first known for doing, that's all it's much like even a singer. That's all they want you to, that's all they want to see so-and-so sing about. And with this filmmaker, that's all the kind of tone and mood that they want to see illustrated on screen. And so, yeah, with Bogdanovich, he basically, you know, got overshadowed by a bunch of other people who were the kings of talkie dramas, like, you know, Woody Allen and John Cassavetes. And then, yeah, and like you say, he just had some great experiences, and much like Coppola, very good at calculating and doing a mixture of authenticity right, mixed with just, again, just very well, good setups. And then just, again, just a few, anyone else could have had these same mishaps, just not make money. And then next thing you know, just, well, now we got to give you more notes and less control. And you got to, and right, there's still movies to these days that I would love to hear him actually speak about. But I think just because he hated making the experience, regardless of whether anyone likes or hates the movie, he just, he doesn't want to talk about it without sounding unprofessional. And he's,
yeah, yeah,
done with that. And it really is a damn shame, because you don't know how much of it is him not saying, you know, yes to the studio heads versus, you know, no.
And yet, as the Beatles said, and in the end, we're all very, very, very lucky to have had these tens of thousands of films that have been set before us to inspire us and to learn from and to be entertained by. And it's, you know, I feel very, very fortunate that I embraced this at a very young age and learned over the past 50 odd years, you know, the things that I've learned and absorbed, and it's enriched my life immensely.
It really is good, and it will be missed. I think Coppola, I will definitely cry like a baby when he passes, because it's just one of those, just like, he, anytime he's spoken at like a film festival or an interview, he really is very intricate. He's very calculated, and you know, he's had almost as diverse a career as Spielberg, and he's just shown a love just for all things, you know, film genres, all.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, and I also feel very fortunate that I've spent a lot of time with a lot of notable people in this industry and got to sit down and talk with them and hang and get to know them a little bit better for small amounts of time, long amounts of time. You know, if you don't end up, you know, acting like a fanboy and you just sit down and have honest conversations with a lot of these people, you find out a lot of really neat stuff, you know, that's, you know, really cool things. If you're a movie lover, you know, like
the number you can't even repeat. Like, just, they told it so damn well. It means so much, something different when they said it versus, you know, us repeating the story. You know what I mean?
I had an incident that literally was mind blowing. I think they found pieces of my skull on the wall because my head exploded about a year and a half ago. I was at the Critics' Choice Association Awards dinner, and that was the year that Irishman was nominated for an awful lot of stuff. And at the very front table is Harvey Keitel, Al Pacino, and Robert De Niro all sitting together. And I've been very fortunate in that I've helped the association with some marketing and things like that. So they always put me at a really good table, and I'm spending the night with an awful lot of notable people. I won't drop names, that's boring, but I had my eye on that front table, and this is a live broadcast, and it's like, so right there is Pacino and De Niro, along with Harvey Keitel. What do I do? I can't not try something. I can't, but I can't be obnoxious. And during one of the commercial breaks, I weaseled my way over to the table, and I just said, excuse me, gentlemen, and they all looked up, and, you know, said, my name is Joe. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm one of the voting critics. They had just won the Ensemble Award, you know, best cast and whatever. Woo. It's sitting there on the table, the award sitting there on the table, and they're focused on me, all three of these guys. And I just said, I don't know what I was saying. And I just said, I just want to thank the three of you for the joy you've given me in my life. The three of you are in my DNA. And I blurted out and I said, I love you all. It was a crazy, nutty thing to say, but it came out of my mouth. And Pacino says, oh, we got to show this guy some love. And Harvey Keitel's wife, girlfriend, whatever, is motioning to me to, like, with, like, she's holding an iPhone, like, come over, come over. And I'm like, I don't want to overstay my welcome. And she's going, come here, come here. And, you know, I went over and Keitel wanted me to sit on his knee. And then Pacino, you know, jumps up and he goes, all right, my turn. And I've got Michael Corleone giving me a bear hug, a squeezy around my waist. And then we take that picture. And then De Niro says, oh, what am I, chopped liver? And I'm like, the man who doesn't even talk, who doesn't engage in conversation, is insisting on taking a picture before the commercial break is over. And at that point, I realized I can die now. And this is 5 years after I hung for 45 minutes with James Caan in a golf cart. That was a crazy time in and of itself. So
I've been with Santino, I've been with Michael, I've been with my young self, and all of it's been an offer I can't refuse. I don't know.
Were you able to try that Marlon Brando impression with any of them, or just you didn't have
Actually, in the golf cart with Caan, he had been playing on a course where my friend was the ranger. For you golfers, you know what a ranger is. And he set that meeting up. And I guess my buddy had said something to Caan about me doing voices. So at one point in the conversation, he was like, all right, so we're going to run some lines here together. I hear you're the voice guy. And I literally was so embarrassed. I said, Mr. Caan, Jimmy, call me Jimmy. Okay, Jimmy. Wouldn't I be like the schmuck of the universe to start doing lines and impressions with you here? I did want to remind him that there really was no dialogue between him and Brando and the Godfather anyway. I didn't want to piss him off, you know, so I sort of sidestepped that. But I sure as hell wasn't going to start doing Pacino and De Niro with Pacino and De Niro. That wasn't happening. No way. No, sorry. Not
they probably got it way too much. Or it was like,
well, that probably would have been the, all right, get the hell away from this table. Hoo-ah, you know, whatever.
I'm not going to do the civilian.
No. But that's a whole other podcast. The notable people I've hung with. That's a whole other conversation. A lot of stories.
That's great. But no, that is good that you were also just careful, because you don't know, you know, it might be a bad day. Everyone always assumes they're, you know, they're not normal people and to some capacity, or that they're always in a good mood. It's like, nope, that crazy or not, they have their bad days. And if you encounter them on a bad day, they'll probably give you, you know,
well, I was awoke enough to realize if Harvey Keitel wants me on his lap, and Al Pacino is giving me a bear hug, and De Niro's fighting over his time to get a picture, just take that. Just take it. That's enough. That's more in your wildest dreams that was ever going to happen to you, ever. So.
Right. Everyone thinks it's like every kind of actor who goes to, like, say, a convention or a special speaking event. Is like, no, totally different scenario. This one, you know, you're at an award show and you got their blessing and you accepted it.
Yeah, I'll never forget it. It was quite a moment.
Hell of a night.
Hell of a night.
Well, thank you ever so much for jumping on board and just kind of summarizing a couple of, you know, just his oversight of film, what he brought to it, and what he's left us with. Do you have any portions that you would like to promote regarding your radio show, if it's still around? Or,
well, you know, if your audience would like to know a little bit more about my nonsense, because I'm in charge of the goofy stuff. Somebody has to be in charge of the goofy stuff. The audience is more than welcome to visit my website, which is voicesbyjoel.com. So
I will link that up for sure.
Well, that would be lovely. And Cam, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, clearly you certainly know a lot about film. I know a lot about film, and I know a guy. I know a guy who knows a lot about film when I hear it, and it's nice to have a conversation with a fellow maniac. I say that with affection.
No, absolutely. I know what you mean. A lot of this stuff, I can't even talk with certain members of my family. They just look at me like, oh, who is this alien? It's like, it's a different language I'm speaking. The lingo, the jokes about, you know, booming the shot, you know. Oh, this OTS shot. What does that mean? Over the shoulder.
Right.
Stop talking near the
TV. I stopped doing that with friends because I lost too many friends. But
I lost them years ago from my questionable movie picks. And they were also the kind that if a movie was just bad, they just had no sense of humor about, you know, a line flubbing or actors who clearly weren't keen on acting alongside another, or just an unintentionally amusing, you know, explosion, just stuff like that. They were they were not those kind of humorous, which is unfortunate. It's like, I think it's a missed art. People just seem to just think, you know, oh, there's movies that are just goofy and entertaining. It's like, yeah, and then there's ones that, you know, they may not be good, but you remember seeing it opening night at a drive-in and it was a hoot.
You know, in the end, it's wonderful for any given person to be passionate about something. I feel bad that people who don't. So
it's so true. It's like the passion has been oversighted by, but were you successful? I'm like, maybe not, but do you not admire that someone loves doing this and can do it? It's all second nature to them. And they,
right.
Well, how much money is he making? Oh my God, no. You're brainwashed by the capitalism.
Right, not the point. Just sit back and watch the movie and shut up. Oh, and pass the popcorn. Thank you.
Yes. And cook it right. Don't just put butter on it.
Yeah. We don't want that Vaseline on it. Just give me the plain stuff. That's all.
All righty. You are the man, sir. Go. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you, Kim.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Hey, I heard you like movies.
I heard you like to hustle.
I heard you like podcasts.
Well, guess what?
There's a podcast for you out there called The Home Video Hustle.
Damn right.
Every Friday, we talk about whatever movie PJ picks out the bag.
What does that mean?
Every Wednesday on our YouTube page, I put a bunch of movies in a bag, and PJ picks one out at random. Mm-hmm. And then we just watch it. We talk about it for maybe like an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. Whatever we feel like doing, wherever the conversation leads us.
But do we actually talk about the movie?
Most of the time.
Ah.
Tangents galore.
Yes.
So believe me, we may be a movie podcast, but it's not always about movies. We might talk about video games.
Mm-hmm.
Music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the big one, music. Sometimes we might get a little bit of politicalness in there.
Yes.
Sometimes we may just, oh, you know what we like to do? We like to tell stories, PJ.
Ah, yes.
I am the master storyteller
yes.
of the podcast realm. Undefeated. So if you like to hear about movies, video games, whatever foolishness comes to our mind, the most random stuff you could think of, check out the Home Video Hustle. You can find us on the Stitchers.
Yes.
The Google Play.
Yes.
Apple Podcasts.
What else?
Podbean.
What else?
Podcast Addict.
Goddamn.
All that. Ain't no reason you can't get your hustle on. We everywhere. Worldwide, baby.
Hustle, motherf***. Hustle.
Hey, we can't cuss in the promo, PJ.
Ah.
We gotta be family friendly. There may be podcasts out there that don't want his hair to say
Yeah.
All that good fun stuff.
Well, you.
Yeah. don't run the listeners away, PJ.
Ah, I'm sorry.
But this is going kind of long.
Yes.
So we'll end this and say, hey, check out the Home Video Hustle every Friday on all the various podcast outlets. Peace.
Peace.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And while Witch didn't make it to the top of the world, he did make the Gangs of Hollywood podcast. So join the gang and enjoy a movie review podcast about movie gangs, gangsters, mobsters, and the mayhem they cause. You can find GOH Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. At GOHpod, at www.gohpod.com, as well as your favorite podcast listening app. And remember, say hello to your little friend for me.
If you take two old punk rockers who are past their prime, put them in front of a movie screen and give them a podcast, what do you get? Cinema Punks. Cinepunks. It's the mixtape of movies.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in you.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that. Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
Unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this movie.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist. Watching this film again, I had all of this, like, little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you know, couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was going to be a rough
movie. How did you watch this shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach, and we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pair it with a couple brews, baby.
We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 bana.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. With a one-liner plot holes and gratuitous boobies, it's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Mac Jackson. I wanted to invite you to a new site called the Forever Adventure Network. This website has everything. Pictures, videos, blogs. There's original music by Harmony Constant. Two podcasts. One is the MacGyver Podcast, where we celebrate Richard Dean Anderson, his iconic roles, and how it's influenced our lives. There's episode discussions, interviews, and life conversations. The second podcast is the Never Gets Old Podcast, where we celebrate all the best things that we love in life, from TV, movies, music, and comics. The site is also the home for the MacGyver SG-1 audio series, an ongoing adventure series that continues the adventures of MacGyver and SG-1. There are also multiple stores to choose from for all of your pop culture and adventure needs. Come on by and check us out today. And thanks for joining the adventure.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a Jacked Up Review Show.